Good morning, Radio New Zealand News with Hewitt Humphrey. Three people died in a plane crash near Wellington last night. The three men were on board a light plane that crashed into a ridge between Baring Head and the Orongorongo station, not far from Cape Palliser, around midnight. Police first heard about the accident when they received a report of what was thought to be a flare sighting, and a check with the capital's airport revealed that a plane had been lost from the radar screen a short time before. A fire was also reported at the area, and a helicopter was sent to the ridge to confirm that a plane had crashed. Police don't know the identity of the three men at this stage, but say the aircraft was on a flight from Paraparaumu to Christchurch at the time. A whirlwind carved a brief but destructive path through part of the South Canterbury town of Temuka yesterday afternoon. The strong wind ripped roofing iron off three houses, uprooted a line of trees, and carried a veranda over a house, depositing it on the other side. An eyewitness, Jack Perry, says the wind whipped through with a flash and a bang and was gone.
Well, I was down in the garage, and this wind came up all at once, and I looked out the window and I could see iron flying through the air and wood, timber, and then I heard a crash, and the shed down the paddock went down. And more iron flying around, and then it was all over. And I could see it going in the distance over Proud Paddocks, and the dust was going up to, say, 600 or 700 feet. And it was all over so quick.
Jack Perry. The whirlwind brought down power and telephone lines, but no one was injured by the flying debris. Māori Affairs Minister Koru Wetteri will meet David Longhi today to explain his role in the Māori loan affair. Mr. Longhi says the meeting was arranged after new revelations in the affair.
Mr. Wetteri has consistently said he did not know of detailed negotiations for a loan until November, but Māori Affairs Secretary Tamati Reedy and businessman Rocky Cribb say the matter was discussed in October with Mr. Wetteri, and Mr. Wetteri planned to go to Hawaii to talk about the $600 million deal. They say the matter was discussed at a meeting on October the 20th, and Mr. Longhi is obviously disturbed at the conflict.
Clearly, when two people who were present at the same meeting are in conflict, you have a problem.
It seems Mr. Wetteri's job is now on the line, and Mr. Longhi didn't rule out any possibilities as a result of his meeting later today with Mr. Wetteri.
In politics, all are at risk.
And from Parliament, Claire Delore.
The Leader of the Opposition, Jim Bolger, has called for a full public inquiry, accusing the government of a cover-up. Mr. Bolger says the government must now heed similar calls.
The conflicts that are emerging, the conflicts in the minister's own statements that emerged in Parliament yesterday, have to be dealt with. And for it to be dealt with in the present procedure, which is one or two questions a day and the events dragging on interminably, I think is damaging to Māoridom, and it would be much better for the government to accept the reality of an inquiry. The issue is a serious one. It now goes right into the heart of government and the credibility and the accuracy of statements that have been made by the Minister and the Prime Minister.
Mr. Bolger suggested a matter of privilege may arise from the Minister's statement to Parliament. Fletcher Challenge is giving up its latest bid to buy out NZ Forest Products and will make a new offer later. Chairman Sir Ron Trotter says 2,600 Forest Product shareholders have accepted the offer, and Fletcher Challenge now holds about 13.5% of NZFP's shares. He said all the reasons for merging the two companies still stand, and he says Fletcher's will be making a new offer once it can get approval from the Commerce Commission. Sir Ron says the new offer will depend on the acceptance of at least 51% of NZFP's shareholders and on no action being taken by Forest Products associate company Rada Investment, which would affect the value of Forest Products shares or the effective control of the company. Now the weather forecast to midnight tonight. Over the North Island, fine except for isolated showers in the west this morning. In Nelson, Marlborough, Canterbury and Otago, fine. In the west from Buller to Fiordland, scattered showers. In Southland, showers becoming confined to the western high country and the coast this morning. And for the Chatham Islands, a few showers. That's national and international news and weather. It's 6:05.
Tēnā koutou, good morning and welcome to this Good Morning New Zealand on today, Waitangi Day 1987. Jeff Robinson here, and today our programme is not as we usually have it, because we're doing a special programme to commemorate or to mark Waitangi Day. In the studio with me now, I have two guests who will be co-hosts through the course of the morning. Hari Williams, well known to us, of course, from Te Reo Aotearoa, the manager of the Maori radio station in Radio New Zealand, and Hari has arranged a whole host of visitors and discussion points for us during the course of the morning. Kia ora, Hari.
Kia ora, Jeff. Kia ora, koe tui whakaro o maina.
And also with me, the Right Reverend Bishop Manohia Bennett, who has come to be, again, a co-host in the programme with us, and we'll be talking to him, and he'll be taking part in the discussions as the day goes on. Kia ora, Bishop.
Kia ora, Jeff.
Perhaps, Bishop, you'd care at this point to offer a mihi, a prayer, a greeting to the nation.
Good morning. The first thing we do, of course, in the normal course of events, is to acknowledge the presence and power of the divine. So let me just open with a short prayer. Tō mātā mātū te rangi, tēnei mātā wā ponoa tō whatunei ki a koe, tēnei wā, a mātā whakamoimiti whakawhetai. Mō au mana ki tanga katoa, o ho mai nei e koe ki a mātā. Aha koa, i a tehi wā, kataka mātā ki roto ki te radu-radu, te mamai rānei, kei tō mohi o te ngā kau, kei reira koe. E hāpai ana, e tieki ana, i aupono a ko ihu kreiti o tō mātou ariki. Āmen. E wāhi tuatahi, he mihi atu ke koutou, ke tātou, te iwi whānui o Aotearoa, te iwi Māori, te iwi Pāhea, me o tātou whanaunga, o ngā mau tere o tō mōna nui ākiwa. Koe nei te rā o te Treaty o Waitangi. I whakakau papatia ngā mātua tīpuna. Hei kaupapa, e noho atahi ai a tātou katoa. Hei ui whānui. Nā reira, te mihi atu nei ke koutou, ke tātou, i rungi tēnei āhuatanga. Me te whakaro anō, ki o tātou mātui tīpuna, ko mene atu rātou ki te tāwahi. Kia ora koutou, a te atu a tātou katoa e manahi. May I take this opportunity to greet the people of Aotearoa, New Zealand, on this anniversary day, on which the Treaty of Waitangi was signed and became a basis for the development of our nation. And despite the difficulties that this development from time to time has taken us into, the progress of both races has been phenomenal. Let us pray that justice and opportunity may be equally shared with all those of us who go to make up the nation. Greetings to you all.
Yeah.
That hymn was sung by the Auckland Anglican Maori Club. E te atua koruia nei o purupuru pai. O God, you have sown the seeds of life.
E te pihopa kaumātua manuhui a tēnā rā koe tēnei ata. He whaka aranei o tātou whakaaro ki te rungarawa mana tātou e arataki i ngā ahuatanga kai mui a tātou i te motu.
Greetings to you, Bishop Manu, for this morning's blessing, as we welcome listeners from throughout Aotearoa, including, of course, Stewart Island and the Chatham Islands, as we'll be examining our profile as a bicultural nation through the moral, legal, historical, ecclesiastical and political implications of the programme. Kia ora, koutou katoa. Perhaps, Bishop, we could begin by talking to you personally about things. Did your ancestors sign the treaty?
Not actually. Did your ancestors sign the treaty?
not actually. How important is it in Māoridom to be a member of a tribe that did sign it or did not sign it? Does it have an effect on the way Māoris look at the treaty?
I don't think so. I think that the treaty was signed by responsible people who, though they belong to other tribes, did do it on behalf of all the tribes that are represented in the Confederation of Tribes throughout New Zealand today. Whoever signed the treaty, we're all under its obligations.
How do you view the treaty now? What would you like to see?
Well, first of all, I think the treaty was a very noble document, and is still a very noble document. It was a treaty, I believe, that was acceptable to the Maori people of the time. There were political reasons for the Maoris wanting to sign that treaty. At the time, we all know that there were other foreign interests in the Pacific who had intentions of taking over New Zealand, and it was more or less, to pardon the pun, but it was Hobson's choice, as it were. And the Maori people, of course, had to decide what imperial power they were going to live with, and they had an idea that they didn't have very much option about living without an imperial power in the Pacific. So in a way, I personally believe that it was a very conscious, intelligent choice that they made to accept the treaty that the British presented them with.
Over the last 4 or 5 years, you personally have been particularly involved in looking very hard at the treaty through the Anglican Commission, as well as through the Hui at Ngarawahi and so on. Has it changed your view of the treaty at all?
Not really. I think it's enhanced my view of the treaty. It has certainly meant for me that the treaty becomes more and more important as we develop as a nation. The reality of our situation, of course, is that basically we are two peoples and we must be one nation, but it must be based on justice and rights that belong to both sides, and the treaty helped to spell out those things.
Is partnership then perhaps the key word in your approach to the treaty at the moment?
At the moment it is, yes indeed. Partnership in the treaty means that we, living together, must live as two parts of the nation, and two equal parts. This is an important concept, because if you go on the popular idea of democracy, where one man has one vote. There are other legitimate parts when it comes to people. And in certain issues in this country, there should be a people vote. The Maoris must have an equal vote with Bahas, in some instances, because it's a people-to-people thing, not a person-to-person one.
I think there may be a number of Pākehā listeners who would find that a difficult concept to grasp. They would say, oh, no, 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 one man, one vote, perfectly reasonable, one person, one right.
Well, I think that if the numerical situation, population-wise, was reversed, they would understand what we're talking about. Mm.
Is there a balance to be redressed of wrongs that have been done, or can those wrongs be forgotten?
I don't think that any wrong should be forgotten so long as there's a chance of it being redressed. The difficulty, of course, is to find a way of doing it. And on the basis of partnership, we have an opportunity to talk together and to work things out for the good of the whole family.
Somebody has to give up something, don't they, in order for the balance to be redressed? You have to somehow persuade people that what they've got for some reason is wrong, and they have to give up something that they're enjoying now. And I guess that's one of the key problems.
Yes, well, I think that's not real. I don't think anybody has to give up anything. What has to happen is that there's proper equity between both sides. As a famous New Zealander said just recently, you know, I think it's a case of both sides of the one coin pushing their own barrow.
Your own position in the Anglican Church is one which has been addressed, or the position of that you formerly held of the Bishop of Aotearoa. It was for a long time an unequal partner, and now that has been changed. Can the same sort of change be made in the nation?
Yes, because in the church, which is part of the whole structure of the imperial institution, you know, they had the same sort of difficulties about how the British and how the white people, how the Pāhā, I prefer the word Pāhā to white people, related to natives and minorities. The church had to see that the opportunities for decision making and the opportunities for responsible promotion were more than equal regarding the Maori people, because they had lost their resources, they had lost their independence, they had lost their entity, a sense of you know, a uniqueness when it came to politics and when it came to development, that we had to devise some means of giving this minority people a status and a responsibility of equality that only the majority who had the power could extend. I think the greatest change for development in this country remains with a superpower in New Zealand. And they're finding it difficult because they don't see any reason why they should change.
Well, maybe today we can give some cogent reasons why change should be made.
Hopefully, it depends on the listener.
Well, one of the things we're going to be doing is looking back to previous Waitangi celebrations, reminding you of some of the history of the celebration, talking to some prominent people, some ordinary people from around the country on their view of Waitangi. We'll have a discussion at about 7:30 with a group of young people, Māori and Pākehā, on what Waitangi means to them. And after 8 o'clock news, we'll be talking with, among other people, the Deputy Prime Minister, Geoffrey Palmer, with Rebecca Evans, with a Professor of History, Keith Sorensen, from Auckland University. They'll be with us as we look through some of the legal problems and the historical problems that the treaty has created, and talk a little bit about the Bill of Rights and Mr. Palmer's wish to enshrine the treaty within that bill and some of the arguments around that. So that's what we'll be doing over the course of the next 2.5 hours, it is nearly from now. But let's start by looking back. Let's go on by looking back, I should say, because, of course, every child knows the tableau which portrays the treaty signing. You know, the one, William Hobson telling the chiefs where to sign, Henry Williams with his clerical bands on, the assorted soldiers and sailors, civilians and hangers-on. Every actor in that drama had a different view of the significance of what they were doing.
This grave state paper, this blanket-brought missionary Magna Carta, was signed by about 5 natives in 1,000 and was understood by about 5 in 10,000. Again, this guy, Sir Charles Clifford, said, "I believe the treaty to have been a sham, a delusion, and a snare. I like it as a snare around the neck of the Queen of England, because she is the other signatory."
"We must unite before we leave this marae. We have been divided by our brethren Pākehā and laughed at. We have been divided by the churches in the past. We have been divided by our tribal differences and our tribal histories. Whakamutua."
But what I was doing was listening to the spirit arising from the hui. And the main thing that I heard was a call for unity, a call for oneness, and the word that was used was kotahitanga.
There is a very strong counter-argument that the treaty is in fact a valid international act.
Approximately $700 million. Now you can understand why they didn't want to ratify it in 1974. Now, let me say this. It is not the amount. It could be $7 billion for all I care. What I am saying is the Crown should not, as a result of the height or the economic conditions of our time, simply write off the bill because it's too much. I'll take the IOU. The former Minister of Finance told us New Zealand had a triple credit rating. I'll take their IOU. And I want to suggest to Koro that if he finds the Treasury and others bulking, simply put down the simple suggestion, 50 million now and the rest on the never never.
Matthew Rathe, and before him, Faimutu Dews, Benekat Tadzi, Hohua Tutangahi, and Tue Werikar, Kia ora koutou. Well, Bishop, that was recorded at the Hui in Ngarawawahia, 1984. Called for a particular purpose. Can you tell us about that, what you had to achieve from it, because you were the chairman?
Well, the hui was called because the nation as a whole was going through a sort of traumatic period, and there was a great need for reconciliation and healing and a sense of direction. And as you have just heard in these statements from that we, there's much talk in both, in all the statements about unity and oneness, not just amongst the Maori people, but for New Zealand as a whole. And I'm sure that a great deal has been achieved in that direction. We can talk, as we're talking now, about our destiny based on the treaty without any rancor or hostility, a thing we wouldn't have been able to do a few years ago. We both, Haere and I, would have been very angry Maoris. And It had been but a very hurtful comments. But now, as a result of what went on at Ngaruwahia, we are able to sit down and talk like this. And, you know, some of the recommendations that came out of the Ngaruwahia hui are now already part of our way of life. We have the tribunal upgraded in many ways. The numbers are increased. The period that the tribunal has to cover goes back to the day the treaty was signed, and these were recommendations made at that hui. Language has become more prominent and more important to the nation, and this also was another recommendation from that hui.
So the process is being slowly worked through now?
Yes. I don't say that the hui was entirely responsible for these developments, but what the hui did was to conscientize the people, both Maori and Baha, to the importance of what is taking place in regard to our language and our legal status and the right of the tribunal to hear cases that date back to the signing of the treaty.
Well, let's pick up the legal point for a moment, because we'll be looking at a lot of the ramifications from the hui and of the treaty during the course of the morning. The moral, political, historical and legal implications of the treaty, according to Dr. David Williams, who's a constitutional law lecturer at Auckland University, cannot be dismissed.
Well, if the Treaty of Waitangi in its Maori text is taken seriously, there is a coming together into a partnership arrangement of two peoples, not an assimilation of one people by the other or domination of one people by the other, but a sharing. And I think the hui was making it clear yet again. Of course, Maori hui over the last 140 years have made this point many times before, that the Maori component in the decision-making in this country has been neglected or not even listened to, whereas this demand was now being made that Maori component has to be listened to. That's what the treaty means, if it means anything, that the Maori component is not something to be dismissed as another minority. The question of the Tangata Whenua status of Maori people, and this again was something that came out of many contributions to the hui, and this is very important in a range of legal issues, especially in the planning law area, that the Tangata Whenua status of Maori people is a special status which is not yet properly recognised in the legal system, if at all, in fact. And if that recognition of Tangata Whenua status is properly addressed, then, of course, the Treaty of Waitangi will have a good deal more life in the real social and economic issues of the present time.
Well, let's talk.